Now broadcasting in English.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague Weekend Programming. I'm Jan Wellinger. In today's broadcast, we look back at the life and work of the late Czech author Hana Andronicová, who died in late December at the age of just 44. David Vaughan will have that look back. That will be followed by a spotlight in which Christian Falvey looks at the long history of Prague's Karlín, dubbed Prague's first suburb, and we'll round things up with another edition from our history series from the archives in its second run. Now, it seems very strange to be talking about the Czech writer Hana Andronicová in the past tense. When she died of cancer on December 20th last year, she was only 44, and until the last month of her life had been at the height of her creative powers. The author of two successful novels, several plays, and numerous short stories, she was one of the most versatile younger Czech writers and will be hugely missed. David Vaughan looks at her life and work.
By a sad irony, Hana Andronicová died just 2 days after Václav Havel, and in the whirlwind that followed Havel's death, many Czech papers devoted only a few lines to her life and work. But the Czech literary scene has lost one of its most gifted writers. Hana's epic novel, Sound of the Sundial, first published in 2001, is one of the most important books to appear in the Czech Republic since the fall of communism. In recent years, Hana Andronicová had worked closely with the Acha Theatre in Prague, and I spoke to the theatre's director, Ondřej Hrab, about her legacy.
For those who met her for the first time, she looked like a tiny, fragile girl. But for us who knew her for a longer time, we knew that she was a strong personality and she always was heading to her goals. She was also very much versatile in her activities.
And also in her writing style. In fact, she wrote in many different styles, different genres, didn't she?
Yes. Actually, she always used the style of her writing according to the topic, what she was writing. From this point of view, she really was using her richness of the language she knew. But she was also good not only in Czech, but also in English.
And before we talk in a little bit more detail about her writing, I think that one thing that is interesting and very relevant to Hana Andronicová's writing and life is the fact that she wasn't a Prague writer. She came from Moravia, from the city of Zlín, which is a very interesting place in its own right and very different, I think, from Prague.
It's a quite small city, but probably the only really cosmopolitan city in Czech Republic. There was a company, Bata Company, and in the 20s, Bata decided to transform this almost like a village or very small town into industrial metropolis. So you can find really modern architecture there. You can find people who live there or the descendants of people who were Bata Company's managers who lived for a while in India or in other countries. So this small town was really connected to the world since the beginning of the last century.
And what's also very interesting is that Hana's best-known novel, Zvuk slunečních hodin, or The Sound of the Sundial, it is in part about Zlín and about the shoemaking industry, and in fact the family that figures most prominently in the book, they do go off to India, don't they, to work for Batya, for the shoe company in Calcutta.
Yes, but not only this. Hana's grandfather was a painter. He was drawing illustrations for the well-known travel books of Hanzelka and Zygmunt. And Hana's grandfather brought the world to their house, and Hana was living with the drawings of Bushmen from South Africa, with drawings of Indians from Latin America. So that was her virtual world already from her childhood.
Back in 2003, Hanna Andrenikova came into the Radio Prague studio to talk about Sound of the Sundial and read some extracts.
The whole book is narrated by two people, Danielle Kepler and Anne Vanier. And these two people have a dialogue during one night, and they discover, they slowly reveal the whole story of Danielle Kepler's family. And I'm going to read a part that takes us to 30s. This part is narrated by little Danielle when he's a boy. His father, Thomas Kepler, comes back to Czechoslovakia to take his wife and his little son to India, where he's working on the construction of the Batya shoe factory. And, of course, Thomas Kepler is quite enthusiastic about India, and he's hoping that his wife is going to like it there. So this is the part. She didn't like it in India at all. She saw the dirt, the mouldering walls of the houses, litter floating in the sludge. It made her feel sick, the putrid stench wafting towards her, the dozens of curs and cats running around, hairless and mangy. She went into fits when she saw crippled children lying in the dust of the street, beggars with hands stretched out. She suffered from phobias about dirt and disease. She couldn't bear the naked face of reality, the raw shape of misery, sickness and dying. The day she saw her first snake, she wanted to go home. Mother India, land of an ancient culture mysterious and inscrutable, broad rivers of rolling yellowy-grey water, silent and everlasting. India.
That was Hanna Andronikova reading an extract from Sound of the Sundial. Hanna had an unusual beginning to her literary career. Andrei Hrab again.
First, she was in business. She was really a businesswoman in this first wave of entrepreneurship after the revolution. She was very young. She was very well-educated. She spoke perfect English. And she, in a very short time, raised to the top management of international and also Czech big companies. And at a certain moment, she decided that she would go a different way, that she would write a book. She stopped the job. She closed herself for 2 years into her room, and she wrote a novel. And when she finished the novel and opened the door of her working room, she realized that the world of business is not for her, that she has totally different values. Writing totally changed her life. She decided to be a writer, and also it influenced her personal life because she divorced her husband and she started to travel and started to live her independent artistic life.
Here is Hanna Andronikova again talking about Sound of the Sundial back in 2003. Pavla Jonsonova asked her about her very distinctive writing style, and Hanna gave an answer that reminds us of two of the strengths that pervade her work. Firstly, her ability to tell a story through the characters to whom the story belongs, and secondly, her rare gift of combining an internal, even confessional narrative with an ability to step outside the story. To this we should add her strong feeling for the musicality of language.
I just wanted to the story flow in the most natural manner, and I think when two people talk, they make pauses. It doesn't really fit. Sometimes it's not chronological. They have, you know, like different sorts of telling the story. Both of them, of these narrators of the story, they both know the same people, but from different angles, and that also gives you a very interesting point of view.
It seems to me that the voice of a young boy is very strong in your writing, that these are like one of the strongest parts of your novel.
I think it's just the luck of people with good memory that I just somehow do remember my childhood and lots of things, you know, so you can build on that. Some people tend to forget, or maybe their childhood were not really something nice, something they want to remember. My childhood was very nice, and I can build on that very much. When Mama first allowed me to go with Sam to the fish market, I was in raptures. I ran here and there in the stifling Babylonian odor and chatter, poking my nose into baskets full of florid shrimps, catfish, and sardines. Sam offered to let me choose to point out which fish I wanted, but that was a superhuman task. I couldn't decide. I pointed to the right and to the left and somewhere else again. I wanted them all. In the end, I did choose. It was a gold-colored fish, topshay. The English call it mango fish, but for me it was a golden fish and I didn't want any other. When I got back, all I could think of was that we would have my golden fish for dinner. I wanted to play with it. I wanted to take it to bed with my teddy bear. Mama got angry. You can't take a dead fish to bed. It is not dead. It's mine. I chose it. Listen to me. I know you chose it, but that fish is not for playing with. If you like, we'll get you an aquarium for your birthday, and you can put another golden fish in there and look after it, all right? And why can't we have this fish in the aquarium? Because it's dead, and dead fish don't swim. They have to be eaten as soon as possible. She lost her patience. If you can't be sensible, I'm not going to allow you to go to the market next time. I lost my patience as well. I don't care. In the evening, I cried in my room while my parents ate my golden fish. I had fought in vain, and what was more, I was afraid my mother would never let me visit the fish market again. I sneaked into the dining room and watched them eating it all up. Papa noticed me. He put his knife down and waved to me to come in. "Do you want to taste the golden fish?" he set me on his knee. He never got angry. I looked at Mama out of the corner of my eye, and she was smiling. That gave me courage. "And when will I get the aquarium?" They looked at each other over my head and burst out laughing.
Hannah's writing then took her to other parts of the world, didn't it?
Yes. It was not only that foreign countries were interesting her. It was more that people from different parts of the world had different faiths, and that was for her interesting. That's why when we invited her for collaboration with our theater, when Jana Svobodová, the director, invited her to work on the project with immigrants and refugees, she joined the project with great effort, and she collected the stories of refugees from the refugee camps, and they together created a show which was called Dance Through the Fence, which showed five different faiths of immigrants who were seeking their new home in Czech Republic. It was, again, totally different work from her previous books.
And also it's something that's very difficult, isn't it, for a writer, especially an established writer such as Hanna Andronikova, to do, to in a way put their own ego in the background and to work with people to try and tell their stories or to help them tell their stories. And it also takes a great deal of empathy, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is something what only few writers know. Usually you have the writer who gives you the text and say, no change. In this case, it was perpetual changing.
And Hannah's last novel, which last year won the Reader's Prize in the Magnesia Litera Awards, went in a very different direction. It was a novel that was in many ways autobiographical, telling the very difficult story of a woman's coming to terms with cancer, with having cancer, and traveling to Latin America, to the Peruvian jungle, to stay with a shaman, and then eventually coming back to Europe to face conventional medical treatment.
This was really a hard time for her, because out of blue, she went to the doctor and she realized that she suffers with breast cancer. She was not prepared, and she decided to go to Peru not to find a healing for herself. She told us that if she was to die, it's nice to die there. So she was ready for everything. It was not that she believed that this alternative method would help her. It was more that it's being together with nature, with some kind of old wisdom, would help her to be ready for everything. You could read the second novel almost like a mystical literature, but at the same time, Hannah was able to look at herself with distance and with a very particular humor. She wrote really parts which you had to laugh, even if it was at the same time the story about the fight with the death. You could not help and you were laughing.
The strong thing to do would be to head out into the jungle, following the trail to the rapids, then on to the cold waterfalls, and there to shout out loud. Instead, she just lies and beseeches, "Lord, have mercy. Kyrie eleison. Christ, have mercy. Jesus Christ." "Calm down, girl. Fear is corrosive. Before long, it eats you up. So up you get. Machete, hat, water, vamos."
So she came back from jungle, from the treatment which actually didn't heal her body, but probably prepared her soul. And she got a classical medical treatment, and surprisingly, it looked like there is a hope. But this hope was only for another 10 months, and then it started again.
And I think one of the things that's most tragic about Hanna Andronikova's early death is the fact that she was such a gifted writer who was so obviously developing so much as a writer from book to book.
This is a big question, because she died so young that you can't say what kind of book she would write next. We were, of course, planning another theater project, and I know that she was planning also to write a new novel. This time, she was thinking to write it directly in English. She was really gifted writer, even in English. She got a scholarship to Iowa for this international writer's residency, and there she wrote some nice short stories in English.
You recently wrote an article in the newspaper Lidové noviny about Hanna Andronikova, and I found it very moving the way that you ended that article.
I was thinking what kind of story her own life is, that this is the story for another novel, that maybe someone would find the courage to write a novel which maybe will have a very simple title, Hanna Andronikova.
Ondřej Hrab was talking about the writer Hanna Andronikova, who died on December the 20th.
Checkbooks with David Vaughan there, looking back at the life and work of the Czech writer Hanna Andronikova. And if you'd like to comment on the program so far, please do so by writing to us here at the station. The address to write to is english@radio.cz. Now, though, it's time for Spotlight with Christian Falvey.
Prague's leafy central suburb of Karlín may best be known outside the Czech Republic for the devastating floods that laid ruin to it in 2002. But much of the world has been using the machines and products born of Karlín factories for more than 100 years. And aside from that, it's also Prague's oldest suburb, a point recalled by an exhibition being held this year at the City Museum in Prague that was created by historian Dr. Zdeněk Mika.
Compared with other areas that surrounded Prague in the Middle Ages, this area was special because it was very sparsely inhabited and based on very sparse inhabitation in prehistory. Archaeologists have hardly ever come up with anything, unlike in neighboring Libang, where there are permanent settlements from even the Stone Age. And at least one reason for this was the danger of flooding. People's experience with this area was that whenever there was a rise in water, this area was flooded. And so no one settled it permanently. It was used for agriculture. There were meadows, pastures, and fields here, but their owners lived in Prague.
There were major floods in Karlín in 1784, 1845, 1890, and most devastatingly of all, in 2002. Today there are plaques all over the quarter marking the surface of the Vltava that August, many of them more than a meter over your head or more. When asked why people continued to build here, Dr. Mika says that that is exactly the question reasonable people have been asking for almost 200 years. In the 13th century, the land here became the property of the Knights of the Cross with the Red Star, who controlled it for the better part of the whole of Czech history, until 1848, when it ceased to be a reminder of the medieval feudal system, and Austrian bureaucrats took over its management.
Karlín was established in a different way than the other Prague suburbs, which grew out of smaller settlements. The Austrian officials at the time simply decided there was going to be a new suburb in 1817 and to call it Karolinenthal. And soon there was a need to name it in Czech as well. Many people assume that with so many things in Prague named after Charles IV, Charles Square, Charles Bridge, Charles University, that the neighborhood of Karlín follows suit. But that is not the case at all. It is named after Caroline Augusta of Bavaria, the wife of the Austrian emperor and Czech king of the time, Francis I. So Karolinenthal, meaning Caroline's Valley. But it was difficult to translate comfortably into Czech, and so the easiest, shortest version won out in the end. Karlín.
There are some beautiful old illustrations of this part of Prague at the exhibition at the City Museum that allow you to explore the many likenesses of an area that has changed radically on a number of occasions. Originally, only fields and the Knights of the Cross Hospital, which gave the area its first name, Spitalské pole, or Hospital Fields. One dominant feature is the main road that in centuries to come would be renamed Kralovská, Royal, recalling the coronation procession of Ferdinand V, which passed down the street in 1836, and remains today as Sokolovska. Another feature in the pictures are the beautiful Baroque brick city walls that extended to the intersection called Florence.
You can see here on this oldest illustration, it's the same territory as today. It was bounded on the one side by the hill of Vítkov, on the other by the river Vltava. One side ended at the fortifications of the new town, and the other went on to Libeň. When the city walls were torn down in the mid-1870s, they left a strip of prime construction land. The walls had become absolutely obsolete, of no use in an age when war was waged in a more modern way. They were an obstacle to traffic and they were falling apart. So Prague, Vienna, all of the big cities of the Austrian Empire at that time had their city walls taken down.
The space taken by the walls was promptly used to construct, for one thing, the City Museum itself, and the last of Prague's beautiful old railway stations, Nádraží Těšínov. That, in turn, was torn down in the 1970s to make room for the noisy, smelly, and generally hideous central thoroughfare that remains the source of so many city planning arguments today. But the central part of Karlín has retained much of its own special character, atypical for Prague because it was originally planned.
The project to build Karlín was designed according to strict requirements beforehand, making a system of right-angle streets, three main longitudinal streets with six perpendicular side streets, a very rational system that was well thought through from the engineering point of view. Karlín was being used to meet needs that Prague, closed off by its medieval planning system, could not fulfill. And so, for example, a major industry of textile printing was built there. There was a paper mill and eventually five minor machine works, including one of the world's major tram producers, ČKD. And it was in Karlín that the first gas works were built to light the lamps of Prague streets.
All this makes Karlín today a region of aged brick smokestacks among beautiful 19th century four-story neo-romantic buildings that served as home and office to middle-class merchants, tradesmen, and industrial managers.
When Karlín got out from under the rule of the Knights of the Cross in the second half of the 19th century very quickly, it became one of the most affluent parts of the Czech lands thanks to the great amount of industry and the cargo dock, now a forgotten arm of the Vltava that has been paved over, a vastly important port that was controlled by the major Prague distributors and bankers. And so, even though it was an industrial quarter, Karlin never had the kind of proletariat character of other villages on the outskirts of Prague, like Žižkov, but more of a bourgeois, artisan environment, a middle class.
Change always seems to move at a rapid pace in this part of Prague, the most evident example of that being the transformation over the last 9 years since the incredible disaster left by the flood.
After the last flood of 2002, Karlin recovered very quickly. You can even say that the neighborhood made money off of it, even though it was a tragic event, and the damage was catastrophic in the weeks, months, and year following. But life returned very quickly to the streets of Karlin, and no one today would recognize that there ever was a flood, and most importantly, the area was modernized tremendously.
There are many sides to Karlin now, from the sleek new office buildings going up along the Vltava one after the other, to the central Karlin streets that seem to have never changed over the last 100 years, themselves home to many a brand new restaurant and café, and the parks and tree-lined streets that have a particular quietness that no other central suburb can quite offer.
That edition of Spotlight was first aired on the 29th of June, last year. And it brings us to our final portion of today's program with From the Archives with David Vaughan.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal.
The unforgettable words of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., delivered on August 28, 1963, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. The speech, addressed to a crowd of 250,000, was a defining moment in the American civil rights movement, and its echoes reached as far as communist Eastern Europe. In Czechoslovakia, the civil rights movement had already aroused considerable interest, and not just because of the pleasure that the regime took in pointing to America's shortcomings. Czechoslovak Radio's correspondent in the United States, Karel Kinzel, had already interviewed Dr. King in March of that same year. Here is a short extract from the interview. Dr. King has just been outlining progress that has been made so far in ending segregation.
These are meaningful changes, but I must not give the impression that the problem is almost solved. There's still a great deal to do. We've come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go.
I have the impression that sometimes the changes we are speaking about are much more surface changes than the real changes.
Yes, I think we must recognize that two or three things are developing which can be dangerous if they're not dealt with. One is a trend toward token integration. That is, having one or a few Negroes in a situation and calling it integrated, so that South Carolina pats itself on the back because it has one Negro in the University of South Carolina, and no violence emerged when he entered. No Southern community has really gone all out with a plan of desegregation. And this, it seems to me, is the job ahead, to transform token integration into good faith compliance and integration. The other fact is that we still haven't touched one of the basic problems in our society. And that is that the Negro is still at the bottom of the economic ladder. He is still in a situation where he earns 50% less. The Negro family earns 50% less than the average white family. Now, as long as there's economic insecurity, there will be many social problems developing. And it seems to me that this is one of the great changes that must take place if we are to have genuine progress.
Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., talking to Czechoslovak Radio's Karel Kinzel on March 15, 1963.
From the Archives with David Vaughan brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks for joining us, and take care.
vous écoutez Radio